Well, good morning, Janet Harrison. Welcome to the Poetry Show on Enlightened Radio, www.enlightenedradio.org. And I just checked, our player is working, so you can listen to us. But we'll podcast this later today and be available also on Facebook. There's a Facebook page called Enlightened Radio from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. I'll be posted there as well and some other places. Janet, I was reading I was listening to Donald Hall's poem that you recommended this morning, Without. And it was very painful, almost to listen to. I found a recording of him reading it. And I was wondering whether maybe we should open with that this morning and see whether,
sure.
But it's a book of the same name, right? Without.
It's the title poem of the book.
Right. And I'm going to let it. It's about his wife, who Jane Kenyon, one of my favorite poets, who contracted leukemia and had clearly a very painful death. Took sounds like the last year. Sounds like it was pretty bad from this poem.
Well, I've gone through his liver cancer. You know, he had liver cancer before that, and they'd gone through that, and, you know, then he recovered. Right. And then she got the leukemia.
Right. Let me get the, where's the video here? There we go. All right. Here we go. Let's.
Without. This is a poem that I began to write during Jane's leukemia, in the present tense, describing the landscape of leukemia we were living through. But when I came to assemble the book of poems about her death, Without, it became obvious that it would be best at the moment of her death. And I put it in past tense and changed a word or two here and there. Without. We lived in a small island stone nation, without color under gray clouds and wind, distant the unlimited ocean, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, without seagulls or palm trees, without vegetation or animal life, only barnacles and lead-colored moss that darkened when months did. Hours, days, weeks, months, weeks, days, hours. The year endured without punctuation. February without ice, winter, sleet. Snow melted, recovered, but nothing. Without thaw, although cold streams hurtled, no snowdrop or crocus, rose, no yellow, no red leaves of maple without October. No spring, no summer, no autumn, no winter, no rain, no peony, thunder, no wood thrush. The book was 1,000 pages without commas, without mice, oak leaves, windstorms, no castles, no plazas, no flags, no parrots, without carnival or the procession of relics, intolerable without brackets or colons. Silence without color, sound without smell, without apples, without pork to rupture, gnash, unpunctuated without churches, uninterrupted, no orioles, ginger, noses, no opera, no, without fingers, daffodils, cheekbones. The body was a nation, a tribe dug into stone, assaulted white blood, broken to shards, provinces invaded, bombed, shot, shelled, artillery, sniper fire, helicopter, gunship, grenade, burning, murder, landmine, starvation. The ceasefire lasted 48 hours, then a shell exploded in a market. Pain, vomit, neuropathy, morphine, nightmare, confusion, the rack, terror. Vincristin, RSC, cytoxin, VP16. Loss of memory, loss of language, losses. Pneumocystis carinii, pneumonia, Bactrim. Foamless, unmitigated, sea without sea. Delirium, whip marks of petechiae. multiple blisters of herpes zoster, and how are you doing today? I am doing. One afternoon, say the sun came out. Moss took on greenishness, leaves fell. The market opened, a loaf of bread, a sparrow. A bony dog wandered back, sniffing a laugh. It might be possible to take up a pencil. Unwritten stanzas, taken up and touched. Beautiful, terrible sentences, unuttered. The sea, unrelenting wave, gray the sea, flotsam without islands, broken crates, block after block, the same house, the mall, no cathedral, no hobo jungle, the same women and men, they long to drink hayfield, no. Without dog or semicolon or village square, without monkey or lily, without garlic.
Well, pretty bleak. I can't remember a poem more bleak. I'm sure there is one, but well, you picked this one out, and usually we read Jane's poetry more than Donald Hall. That's actually one of the first. That's the only time, this first one I've ever heard him read. Well, what's your take on that? I can't hear, you're muted.
Sorry.
Yeah, you go. Okay.
It's written without punctuation, and so I'm glad you had him read it, because I wasn't sure how to read it where he wanted the pauses, because it's just a whole block of text. But I think it was just very powerful. It captures the sense of loss and pain, and it doesn't shy away from it. It's just really, but it also kind of crafts it so that it's almost, you know, you can listen to it, and you can really feel it. But when he weaves in the drugs that she has to take, and all of that, you just sort of, as a pharmacologist, you just,
right. Oh, yeah. Right. Right. You. well. Yeah. It's like. You know, you opened a closet, and for some reason, you know, tons of stuff that was sitting up there falls down on you. You know, of every description that you had stored.
I thought it was very honest and very true. Very a poem of absence.
Yeah.
It wasn't the poem I started with when I started crafting the show, but it was one that came to me as I was thinking about absence, because I thought it's one of the best poems ever written about the loss of somebody in absence.
It sure is. Yes, it was. Well, I mean, I know when I think about, you know, those grief-ridden poem, there's a lot of them, actually. You know, what's Coleridge's famous one? Ode to Dejection or something like that? Or one of his odes. A grief. I can't remember. It's a grief. He describes it. It can't be born. And, but it's a, now you've read the whole book. I didn't, this is the lead poem in the book. Does he, does the rest of the poems?
I haven't read the whole book in a while. Right. I took it out of the library. I don't own it.
Right.
It's a very powerful book, and you know, very. And you know, what can a poet do when they're grieving? You know, except write. I mean, it helps a little bit.
Right.
There's all those absences, but there's also they're recalled by saying no. Mm. You know, so. Even though you're negating them, you're recalling them.
Right. Well, he certainly, it's like the 1,000 moments just, you know, piled on together that, and they give you an impression of the weight of this suffering.
Yes.
So, well, there's an interesting, you know, I mean, there's a power to his poetry that I recognize. it's not the same power that she has in her poems, which seems to be more subtle. And I don't know, might hang with you. There's something about her poems that just stay around. It's like you wear a bracelet, or you have they're a token. You remember them. They're not a judgment. But anyway, hard to put into words. If I was a poet, I could do better. Anyway, do you think, on this kind of a poetic journey through an illness, for example, and there have been other writers that went on at length, about, you know, the what happens when you get seriously ill, or when you where the death takes months or years to take place, but it's inevitable, and it's a little different than the sudden tragedy, right? Very different, actually. Have you got a cat on you near there?
Yes, I have a cat.
We're on Zoom here doing this studio here, folks, and so you know, as you're aware, all kinds of things happen. Okay, well, now you also had on your list, if I'm not mistaken, a poem by Wordsworth called "Surprised by Joy."
Yes.
How would you now? Did I pick the wrong one to go first, or do you have a
no? This was fine. I like the order we're going to be doing it in now.
Okay, so
the order the way I developed the show, but it works better, I think.
All right. Well, tell me about William Wordsworth. Okay.
Well, he was one of the Romantics, a like poet. He and Coleridge did some work together, and then of course the contemporaries were Byron and Shelley and Keats, and they were all aware of each other. Not necessarily approve of each other, but they were aware of each other. Byron, for example, didn't like Keats. One of his slips.
Of course not. You know, he was trying to start a revolution someplace, right?
Yeah. Well, he fought in Greece in the Greek Revolution.
Yeah, right. I know.
But Wordsworth was, and he had a sister, Dorothy, who was, people are starting to pay more attention to the role that she played in his writing. But he also was married and he had some children. He lost one of his children. I don't know. Did he lose more than one of the children?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
There was at least one of his children died. And that, I think, is the subject of this particular poem. But I always loved the opening to this poem, "Surprised by joy, impatient as the wind." I've always loved those lines. And then then the poem changes into a poem of mourning. But I picked it because it's got the same movement as the last poem we're out on, which is the Philip Levine, or Levine, or however you say his name. I should have looked that up. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, by the way, I remember a great anecdote when I was in graduate school in English at one point about Coleridge and Wordsworth's friendship, where Wordsworth was always trying to tell Coleridge that he should take more walks in the woods and get out of London more often, and that his vision might improve, and so. He was reluctant to do it, but he did. They went on a number of walks. You know, I'm not sure quite where they did it, but I'm not sure that it was anywhere near Tintern Abbey. But anyway, they went on the walks, and Coleridge observed that when Wordsworth was walking through the woods, he had his eyes closed.
Know that.
Whereas, you know, Coleridge was always, you know, very much a person into the details of the visual details of things are, you know, it's one of his gifts. You can a picture of a flower can be a path to heaven. But I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, because Wordsworth's poetry is pretty intellectual, it seems to me. But anyway, why don't you read this poem, and let's see whether or not my memory about this is right.
Okay, this is Surprised by Joy by William Wordsworth. Surprised by joy, impatient as the wind, I turn to share the transport. Oh, with whom but thee, long buried in the silent tomb, that spot which no vicissitude can find. Love, faithful love, recalled thee to my mind. But how could I forget thee? Through what power, even for the least division of an hour, had I been so beguiled as to be blind to my most grievous loss? That thought's return was the worst pang that sorrow ever bore, save one only, when I stood forlorn, knowing my heart's best treasure was no more, that neither present time nor years unborn could to my sight that heavenly face restore.
Wow.
So something happens. He gets really happy. He turns to share it with somebody, and then he realizes the person he most wants to share that moment with is not with him anymore.
Right. Instead. So you think this was referring to one of his child that passed?
Yes, I mean, it's both his children.
Right. Well, it's
I could be wrong. I'm pulling that from memories of graduate school.
Yeah, right. Right. You know, where we hope that some of the stuff we were told was true. Anyway, it's very Wordsworthian. That last sentence there, I mean, is an example of that sort of you have to follow his train of thought kind of carefully. That's a very different, it's interesting how it's quite a different take on the reaction to loss than Donald Hall's poem. Actually, it sounds a little bit like the loss in Wordsworth's thing is more distant.
And yes.
Donald Hall sounds like it's still so fresh and raw in his mind that... And he says he wrote part of it while she was still ill, before she passed on, before Jane Kenyon passed on. So it's like you're there by the bedside in the in the Without poem. Whereas with the Wordsworth poem, you know, well, there's all, you know, no matter where you are and what you're doing, there's something missing. You know. You know, it reminds me also of the power of those of remarking and noting and making ceremony over the losses that we have. You know, one of the principles of unionism is it only has a couple, actually. You know, and one of them is don't leave anybody behind. And the other one is find something for everyone to do. But and you can't. You have to leave some things behind. I mean, you're forced to in life. You know, it's like when we're, but there's a moral principle or a communal principle. I don't know, community principle or something like that, that gets invoked. You know, like, for example, in a shop, you know, where you have, and the company comes out and says there's going to be a big layoff. It's like one of those moments, right? Because you're in relationship, right, with a whole bunch of people, right? And sometimes for years. And, you know, that sense of, wow, all those relationships are now just been wiped out, like a flood came through and took out the left side of the road. Something like that, right? And you fight against it, you know, with trying to find a way to save the people, even when you can't. And I know we would always work hard to save anybody. If we couldn't save everybody, we would save as many as we could. Motivated by that kind of, you wanted to try to prevent that loss, if you could. That's what it reminds me of that anyway. You had another poem on the list. What's the other poem? I just set it up.
It's Philip Levine's Alone. Let me pull that one up.
Oh, that's right.
This was a sonnet, by the way. It was a formal poem, so it was very controlled. And, you know, written, you know, more than 100 years before. Okay, where is his Alone?
Oh, I have
here it is.
Here.
Okay. Philip Levine, Alone. And this is a very different poem. Philip Levine is known as a poet of the industrial Midwest. He writes a lot about his youth working in...
the automobile industry, right, in Michigan, right.
And this is a very different poem for him. This is a poem set in California where he lives. But to me, when I read it, I hear a hint of, you know, from my hiking in the Appalachians, I hear a hint of that, even though we just know olive groves in the Appalachians. I think on the trails that I'm familiar with, not the trails in California.
Right.
But anyhow, this is called Alone. Sunset, and the olive grove flames on the far hill. We descend into the lunging shadows of goat grass, and the air deepens like smoke. You were behind me, but when I turned, there was the wrangling of crows and the long grass rising in the wind and the swelling tips of grain turning to water under a black sky. All around me, the thousand small denials of the day rose like insects to the flaming of an old truth. Someone alone, following a broken trail of stones toward the deep and starless river.
Wow. Could you read that one again?
Sure. Alone. Sunset. And the olive grove flames on the far hill. We descended to the lunging shadows of goat grass, and the air deepened like smoke. You were behind me, but when I turned, there was the wrangling of crows and the long grass rising in the wind, and the swelling tips of grain turning to water under a black sky. All around me, the thousand small denials of the day rose like insects to the flaming of an old truth. Someone alone, following a broken trail of stones toward the deep and starless river.
Whoa, a starless river. Right? So it was a starless river. Wow. Yes.
Poetry magazine. I'm getting it off the Poetry Foundation website.
Right. Yeah.
Just to be distribution. And it's Philip Levine. And I think it's so beautiful because he's walking and he's just thinking like there's somebody with him. You know, it's just one of those sense of a presence that's so strong. And then you turn and there's no one there and you realize you're alone. And that ending, you know, someone alone following a broken trail of stones. Toward the deep and starless river, I think it's just so powerful.
Something about a starless river that's
yes, that's unexpected. It ends on such a beautiful.
It's
just such a beautiful and powerful
conclusion. Now, there's an interesting thing about poetry, and you know, you put together two incongruous words, ideas. Symbols, whatever, and you learn something from the incongruity. It's like remember the painting of the dogs playing poker.
Yes,
you know the
hugging people's
right. You know, so I mean, there's something about that that instant incongruity, right? You know, that what do you mean, star into the starless river? But it works, right? It's interesting. It wouldn't work all by itself, but in the context, he sets it up and it works. It's a powerful close. I like that a lot. Philip Levine, and when you said an industrial, he wrote great poems about the people and the kind of things that happen in manufacturing plants that, you know, it's odd that, you know, like 100 years ago or 70 years ago, you had a great, much bigger percentage of the population, you know, working in factories than you do now. And it was, you know, I mean, I got to do that, you know, a couple of times, and I got to represent people who were doing it all the time. And it's a unique culture. It really is. And in so many ways, people drawn together by necessity, they don't like being there. They wouldn't be there at all, except for the money. And yet the collective aspect of mass production and how everybody has to play a very specific and integrated role to get it done is not an experience everybody gets to have. I guess if they're on a football team or an athletic team, you get a little bit of that, but not quite the same because I don't know why. It's just not quite the same. Anyway, Philip Levine captured that quality just beautifully. And so it's interesting that he was, his young life was in Detroit, but I think he taught in Sacramento or in California college system,
yes,
didn't he?
Yeah. Fresno, I think.
Well, Fresno, okay. At the foot of the Sierras, right? He used to represent a show.
But no, I chose this poem to contrast with the Surprised by Joy poem because it's got the same movement. You know, you're doing something, you turn expecting somebody to be there, and they're not. And then Wordsworth goes on to mourning, and Philip Levine just ends purely on the moment of aloneness. You know, there's no mourning or anything. It doesn't even tell you what he expected to be there is. But it's the same moment, the turning towards something that's not there. And I thought that there were two very different poems with the same movement in them. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
My favorite of them was the Philip Levine.
Me too. There's something just very nice about the way that he closed that moment where he looks behind him and sees the crows.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, when I turned, there was the wrangling of crows and the long grass rising in the wind and the swelling tips of rain turning to water under a black sky. It's just beautiful language.
Yeah, it is. It's very good. Well, I think that's good. So, well, you know, we all have these moments, and you've just captured three of them, Janet. The Donald Hall poem is, you know, it's just It's the one that will probably stay with me. It's interesting here today, just because I feel for him and his loss. I mean,
yes,
and he's still there. He's not out of it. He's not doesn't have any distance from it at all. And he's trying to find solid ground, but all these images just keep crashing in, and it's like present. It's present. He talks about that right in the beginning about how he wrote it in the present tense.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that was because it was still with him. You know, it was immediate and still with him. Wow. All right. Well, we're at a perfect half hour poetry show, Janet, with three lovely poems. Would you like to have a moment to close this out?
Well, just it's like, what can a poet, you know, when you think about that, you know, what can a poet do with their emotions except write a poem? You know, what could Donald Hall do with this tremendous, unbelievable, life-changing event of losing his, you know, life partner and love, but try and write about it, and it comes out so brutal and so raw, and yet it's got a kind of terrible beauty to it.
It does.
And then Wordsworth, it's more controlled, in a formal poem, in the language of his time, very, very formal. And the Philip Levine, it's just the simplest. But again, I think my favorite of the poems. It was just, just the walk, and you turn and someone's not there. It's like walking down the street and you think you see somebody and you realize that you can't have seen them because right. They've been dead for 10 years.
Yes, right. And it happened to me about my friend Robert Garcia once. Yes. All right. Well, that's just great. I think it's a good point to bring it to a pause here. All right. We'll be back next Wednesday. All right, with the poetry show. And thank you guys for listening. You can find our podcast at podcasts.enlightenradio.org. And also, actually, there is a website that was inactive for a while, but called poetry.enlightenradio.org. And I actually post these things to that site as well. All right. Well, thank you so much, Janet. And we'll be in touch. Okay. All right.
Okay.
All right, everybody. Take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next.